Janet from Clark County.
Brian Cass, City of Richfield.
Ron Onslow, City of Richfield.
Dave Scott, City of Washougal.
Pete Bell, City of Kansas.
Jeff Brothers, Town of Yackel.
Jeff Sarvis, Eagle Center.
Philip Johnson, Belgrade.
Julie Olson, Clark County.
Michael Torres, Clark County.
And Samantha Whitley with Community Services.
Beth Albert, Longview River Middle Health.
Mike Sharp, City of Oakland.
Thank you very much. Okay, do we have a motion to approve the minutes of October 10th?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
And election for vice chair. Do we have any nominations for vice chair or volunteers?
Yeah, we've got some new mayors here, don't we, Ron?
Since he's on time, we should, I nominate Phil.
This time next year, I won't be here. Because I'll rotate out.
That's a year.
Okay, fine. I was hoping that would just pass by.
A second. All those in favor, Phil Johnson, vice chair?
Aye.
All vote.
Okay, CDBG and home presentations. So that turns over to me.
So the first presentation, are you comfortable starting earlier than the report? Is Glen River Mental Health. And do we need to?
No, they don't have a PowerPoint.
Oh, okay,
so
gotcha.
I'm Beth Oliver. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at Columbia River Mental Health, and I'm here to give you an overview of our proposed project to improve, do projects that preserve our facility and do some major system replacements. The mission of Columbia River is to provide comprehensive behavioral health and recovery services that transform the lives of children, adults, and families in the communities of Southwest Washington. We have clients in all of your jurisdictions served at our facilities at the May Clinic in Battleground, in Hazel Dell. We have an office downtown. We have a residential facility in the Orchards area. Our main clinic, where these projects will occur, is a 42,000 square foot facility that was constructed in 1975 and was renovated in 1999 when Columbia River purchased the facility. Most of the systems are original to that remodel or even before and are nearing their end of nearing or past their end of life. The main project that we are going to propose is the removal and replacement of our 90-ton rooftop chiller. It cools the building. It's a critical building system, and it simply cannot fail. And so it is nearing the end of life. In the packet that we sent out, and I'm sorry, I didn't bring another copy of it, our maintenance vendor has inspected all of our heating and ventilation systems, and this is his top recommendation for immediate budget and replacement.
What's the address of this building?
6926 Northeast 4th Plain. It's near the intersection of Andreessen and 4th Plain. We have, in the past few years, replaced the boiler, added HVAC control systems, and done some other HVAC repairs that have generated significant energy savings for us. So we would expect that this chiller replacement would result in additional energy savings as well. While we're at it, there's a supply fan VFD that they recommend that we replace. That's about $5,000. And so we're going to replace that at the same time. We have other things that we want to do, some interior VAV zone changes that would improve the ability to cool one part and heat one, improve the heating in one part. That is not part of this project, but it is. It will be a future project. The along with the rooftop, the chiller is on part of a flat roof that needs replacement. We've had our sloped roof replaced with CDBG funds, thank you, over the past few years, and that is working out well, but the flat roof was not part of that. It's a very different kind of roof, and the sloped roof wasn't considered an urgent priority at the time. But that roof is beginning to fail significantly. We kind of fixed it for the winter, and to stop some of the leaks, we've already had to replace a corner of the building and some walls because of intrusion and mold created. So we repaired that. We spent about $3,000-$4,000 sealing the roof for the winter. Those repairs have vanished already with the winter, the snow piling up, and then last Thursday's rain. The last page is a picture of that damage. That's sort of the ongoing damage. We were just ready to replace these doors when the rains came. The water is going, seeping in, coming through the roof, and then down this particular door, damaging the door, the walls, and coming into our North Star Clinic. And this is their entryway. So that is not part of the project, but it is a project that we're going to have to complete sooner rather than later. The last part of our request is to retrofit our lighting. We had hoped to do that last year, but funds didn't become available. We do expect additional savings, another 50,000 kilowatt hour savings in electricity, and that would amount to about $5,000 per year of electricity savings. This is part of our total capital plan over the next 3 to 5 years of about $1 million of facility things, and then office interior kinds of things. Our workstations are probably original to World War II, I don't know. Some of them are very, very old, and we need to start replacing those kinds of things as well. We've limited our application here to a minimum amount because we recognize that the community has lots and lots of good projects and not enough funds available to fund all of them, and we want to keep our request modest. Thank you. It's $100,000 in total between the city and the county, and I'm not sure the final allocation is final.
So if 25 grand came your way, would you turn it away?
No.
Yeah, I've walked through the building, took a tour, and it is an older building, and they've done a great job of using the funds that they have gotten in the past. They're busy. They're doing a lot of work there for the community. I can see where any money that they could get could be used to benefit what they're doing there. So.
What would you do if you didn't receive the funding?
Well, we would probably have to patch together something for the roof. At least we might be able to. The boiler hasn't failed yet. We might cross our fingers and try again in another year for funding. But by next year, we would definitely need to have that money.
So the roof?
Right now, the roof has increased in urgency because the patches didn't last.
So the $171,000 project cost, that covers the chiller, the roof, the VFD, and the LEDs, is that correct?
The roof, the south building is $31,000 and the north building is $26,000. But that excludes any cost if we didn't replace the chiller at the same time. They still need a crane to lift it up so that the people don't get like that. Which might damage the chiller. I would.
We do have two handouts that we will start around the room, if you don't mind. Thought we wouldn't bore you with, well, bore you with a handout instead of a PowerPoint. My name is Brad Berry, and this is Melanie Tahinka. We are from Consumer Voices Are Born, better known as CVAB in our community. We are a peer-run organization. And we are here to talk to you about improvements in one of our facilities, a facility that was given to us by the county a few years ago. We all want to make improvements. That's what we're here for, to seek some funds to support our improvements. And our organization is into supporting people, improving their lives, improving the circumstances in their lives, and even improving where they live and how they live. And to do that, we need a facility that's supportive of those endeavors and those efforts. Our organization is a peer-run organization in that the people sitting in front of you are the people who are living with mental illness and or an addiction recovery. We support each other in the work we do. Therefore, we know what the barriers are. The barriers are to improving our lives, the barriers to getting housing, sustaining that housing, employment, sustaining that employment, developing life skills, the soft skills that we need to move forward. One of the things that we've discovered in our more recent journey is that our facility has become a barrier for people to move forward. And we need to make improvements to our building, one way or the other, to make sure that people feel supported, and people feel like they can access it. Oftentimes when we're dealing with a mental health issue or dealing with an addiction issue, any kind of obstacle becomes, I just can't do that, and we turn and walk away. So we want to reduce that happening to people. Our building is over 50 years old. We actually have two buildings on the properties next to each other. We've been piecing the roof together and remodeled together in the smaller facility, but the larger facility just needs major overhaul. There was a remodel in 2010. Unfortunately, when that organization did the overhaul, they didn't bring it up to ADA standards at the time. So we need to bring the building up to ADA standards. We need to provide a safety egress so that we can increase the capacity of the building. We need to open up space within the building so that we can access it. We aren't actually able to use the first floor for services because it doesn't meet ADA standards. Hallways are too narrow, doorways are too narrow, those types of things. And we just, there's not functional space for us down there. It used to be a residence. And then finally we need parking. So as we flip over the document that I sent around, we talk about our needs. When we did have an ADA assessment, we found that there were 37 deficits. We've improved 15 of them over the years with funds that we could put together, but we need to continue to work on putting those funds together, and we need to increase meeting all the ADA corrections that we need in the building. We also, and you can see the picture of the bathroom, that first floor bathroom, we can't use at all. Matter of fact, that handrail you see back there, if you pull on it, it will come out of the wall. So we just shut down that bathroom to use for anybody. And we have two upstairs that people are able to access. But getting from downstairs to upstairs and upstairs to downstairs is not an easy task, since you have to go outside the building, down a public sidewalk and around, which is very steep because of the corner we're on. You can see in the picture where we are, the two addresses, those are our two houses, our two properties. We want to remodel the first floor to make those ADA improvements specifically down there and just to open up the space. So that people are able to access that space and able to utilize it more as an education and employment training center that we have envisioned for a number of years. Again, we supported last year about 50 people finding jobs. These are people that have significant barriers. The year before, about 75 people. So we are able to make progress, but there's a whole lot more need in this community, as you're all well aware. And then parking. You can see the parking issues. We have 10 staff that work on those two properties, and we have 11 parking places. The pictures below illustrate just one day there. We had 21 cars in 11 parking places. And when people have to leave our property, they're backing onto Fourth Plain, which, as you can see, that's a pretty busy intersection. That's right by the Toyota Scion dealer. And so, you know, it's a danger. And also, there's blind spots. The backing out from behind the VOC staff, that's where staff typically park. And you can see the number of staff parked in the bottom picture behind the building. We are backing into traffic coming up around a blind curve. So it is a danger. And if any of our participants happen to park down there, is it a danger to them as well? C-Tran has to, or the C-Van can't pull into our parking spaces. They have to let people out on the streets. There is a bus stop right in front of our Reach 2 house, which is right next to the Val-Ogden Center. But the C-Van, of course, takes different kind of time and different kind of access for people. So we're concerned about it. So our ask is a lot. We're given this property because we tried to get grants in the past, but because it was owned by a government entity, obviously we couldn't get grants to improve this property. So we took a swing at this in the past, we're still learning this process, and then this year we thought we'd ask for all we can. So first we want to prioritize ADA, second to remodel, and then third we have to improve the parking. So questions?
You own property behind those buildings, the grassy area, I guess it is?
Yes, that's where we would plan on extending the parking. You can see a small shed behind the VOC building there. That shed would be torn down. It's not a healthy shed. It would be nice reclaimed wood for someone. And we would extend the parking beyond that into that grassy area. Right below us is that RV park. We think we could get up to about 20 parking places by doing this. We've had both construction companies come in and look at the building and an engineer just come in and kind of eyeball the property. We probably have to build a retaining wall along that south edge of the property, which means that's where the cost really is.
Have you gone to the city of Vancouver yet? You say you're asking them money as well.
We applied to the city of Vancouver and our meeting is in the middle next week. Okay.
So $571,000. This outfit gave you $100,000.
We would start with the ADA improvements and the remodel improvements. We'd also be able to put some of the folks that we support to work in doing some of the work themselves. We've done that in the past in the other buildings.
So if Vancouver's going to be down totally and you only get $100,000 from us, you can still move forward?
We're going to move forward, yes. We have to. Thank you.
$1,500.
Over 3,000 through the region, but just those two programs.
Are you leasing the building from the county?
No, we own the building. The county gave the building to us through a quick claim deed, which means that it's tied. The money that was used to purchase the property originally was for mental health purposes only. So we're a mental health serving organization or a behavioral health serving organization and a peer-run organization, which makes us rather unique. But we tried to get funds to improve it before that. And the county didn't want to keep trying to maintain the property either. Again, it's over 50 years old. So we thought this was the better path. The money was intended, came from the state originally, and it was intended for these purposes. Of course, nobody ever does the long-term planning about maintenance and how do we upkeep this property or improve this property. So we've been given that task. And we're gladly taking it on if we can start kludging it together.
And one more question. Otherwise, unlike our previous folks, you're not taking water. The building is suitable as far as the elements.
On the VOC side, the big building, the around where the air conditioner sits on the roof that supports the kitchen work, because we have a commercial kitchen there to train people in working in the kitchen, we take water in there from time to time. We've been patching it through the years. That building, though, the roof is much more secure. We just replaced the roof on the other building through a smaller grant that we received. So we've been seeking other funds over the last couple of years to improve the property. This is just a big project, and it needs to be done. To be done efficiently probably and effectively, it needs to be done more at once than in pieces.
Do you have a breakdown on the three sort of different components of the project as far as dollars total?
We do in the description of our application, or in the bid from the contractor?
Yes, because construction guy gave us kind of a breakdown. The ADA and the remodel are almost mixed together.
Sure.
Because we have to move walls out, open door frames up. So as we do that, we're going to move a bathroom, flip it so we actually extend another room, get rid of a storage area because the bathroom and the meeting room is a priority over the storage contain or the storage room. So I believe it was around 200 grand to do the remodel with that and create the egress from the second floor, a safety egress. There's three exits, but we need a fourth upstairs to come out kind of the southwest into the upstairs unit for safety purposes. The limit, we're limited to 49 people upstairs in a building, you know, it's a 5,000 square foot cavernous place
right.
that we could really effectively use differently if we had could increase capacity.
But basically what you're saying is that if you start one, you got to do them all.
Well, the parking in the building can be separate.
Part,
yeah, but
I mean in the building and
yeah,
the ADA.
And we would, again, try to figure out a way to use other resources. We know that there are, we're always looking for other resources.
Sure.
The grant we've just using is a Discount Tires Driven to Care grant, a nice little foundation grant, but they helped us. The other building was leaking in the immediate need. So we would, the ADA first, the remodel would be part of that on the first floor. There are other ADA needs within the rest of the building, handrails, for instance, up one side, and we didn't want to bring you 37 pages of pictures of it, the assessment that was done.
I just wanted to make everyone aware we're at the 10-minute mark.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being early. This will advance the slide forward.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. My name is Jonathan Colon. I'm the Vice President of Business and Economic Development. And this is Will Suarez. He's our guy on the ground here in our Vancouver office serving Southwest Washington. Our organization is a 23-year organization that has been serving Oregon and Southwest Washington for that long, and it does it in a couple of ways. One of their major programs is the one that I'm responsible for is the Economic Development Program that started about 15 years ago. We are a chamber, so we have chamber activities. We have about 926 members with about 20% coming from the southwest side of town. Our technical assistance program started on a pilot program in 2002, and in 2004 it began its first program using Community Black Grant Development Program. This actually has become a model, and that model has been duplicated in a couple of other jurisdictions. And I've presented on a couple of national platforms to move some of this work with microenterprise practitioners working with the target population that we'll talk about.
It was automatically kind of advanced.
Okay, that's fine. I'll try to catch up with what's moving up there.
Or you may want to back up.
Yeah, right. You guys can read this fast enough?
No.
Wow, that was pretty fast. Okay. So the project, the intent of the project is to do the one-on-one side of the equation. And then a lot of programs use a program, and we're not a program. or a curriculum. These are programs that you come in, you hear, and you don't get to do the deep dive that you actually need to do with the population that we're serving. A lot of times, you have to create an individual recipe. So our business development coordinators, there's four of us, and we swap. So different individuals of us have different skills, so it allows us to come from different markets into other markets to develop our small businesses. But what we actually do is really look at the person and use a whole bunch of different tools to create a customized recipe on what that particular individual needs to move them from where they are today. And it's a time-based program, sort of time-based recipe that as you cook, you always taste and then readjust. So curriculums don't do that, and programs actually don't do that. So we develop our business development coordinators and our counseling by having a series of tools that are deployed at different times based on the need. And we are all about the long-term impact and not necessarily the short gains. The short gains are part of that adjustment as you move forward through it. I have no idea where you are behind
me. Yeah, that's a backup.
Okay. Our main objective is actually to target the very low 30%, 50%, and 80% MFI. We bring some resources from other projects, some foundations are supporting our work, some banks are supporting our work for Southwest Washington and Clark County. And that allows us to do sort of the high level touch. It doesn't let us get deeper and do that long-term sort of deep dive that a lot of small businesses do. Right now, we on our high level, it's really easy to do. I just closed on a 20-acre farm up in La Center. This is a client we've worked for 10 years to get him to get this farm-to-table objective that he had. There's a little guy with a little concession stand and has worked through the system. Our resources right now allow us to do that high touch, right? I just need to get a whole bunch of people in a room, develop an acquisition plan, and then send them out to implement it. Now, on the other side, we have a small manufacturer who's doing jewelry, and she's working outside of the region. And she needs a lot of resource to do some of the international trade or some international buying and sourcing that she needs for that kind of stuff. I'm going to learn how to do this for the next time I come here. The aim is to create an environment that allows Latino entrepreneurs to really, really blossom. One of the big challenges that Latino entrepreneurs have is that they work in isolation, one, and a lot of them begin at home. So in a lot of communities, you won't even see them. So that's one of the biggest challenges we have on this side of the river is that people are outside of the city, and they're only coming at home, and they're not putting up their shingles in the cities. We're working with a lot of individuals who just want to come home. Clark County is an amazing place. They have great schools. They just want to come home. And we're working with one of the larger, best Latino media company who lives in Clark but has to work in Vancouver, has to work in Portland, and has to because that's where the market is right now. She wants to come home. She wants to be able to do soccer with her kid. Her priorities are being home. So those are the kind of things that we are working with, bringing those resources and those experience and those market share that we've learned in other jurisdictions so that Latinos who are working on this side can leave their home-based businesses and actually get out and do some shingles on the street, right? We have there's a courier service for banks. She has five cars. She still hasn't made that 80% MFI. She never has to leave her home, but it's in her best interest to actually be in a brick and mortar somewhere in Main Street. Well, that was me at the end. It's on my clue to go. Let's see. I'm getting close. Okay, thank you. One other thing is the population has grown really significant. There's some estimates about 40,000 Latinos in Clark County. That's undercounted, and there's a whole bunch of reasons as why that happens. It's usually bad for government to try to do assessments with during business hours when people are having two jobs and they're working long distances. So that's one of the biggest issues. And then there's also the issue about people not necessarily being comfortable connecting with jurisdiction, right? Government and those bodies that represent government. We do this through, let's see, I should have waited for
our Vancouver partners go through, then it would have. Okay. Sorry, guys. I apologize. Let's just give you my qualifications. So our program overall has done about 3,000 small businesses. 52% of who we serve tends to be women. 20% of the requests, we serve about 500 people a year that come through our office. Our Vancouver office right now saw last year about 129 requests for services. There's about 60 small businesses who are actively working on long-term plans, so they're enrolled in a program. We've done about $11 million in micro financing in a whole bunch of different formats, everything from IBAs to actually legalizing sort of personal family lending, just because it becomes an issue if you don't have a document to do that. And I think we've done a little bit over 2,000 jobs we've impacted with either created or saved. And the way that this model works the best is to do self-employment as the first step, as a poverty reduction tool, and then from self-employment, you start putting in the systems in place for the next hired, and then on and on and on and on. Sorry. It's just like... questions?
So the 60 grand will be to keep Will moving forward?
Keep Will moving forward. And it would allow Will to do is to actually go deeper. Right now, we can get someone in the door. We'll spend an hour with them and do an assessment of where they're at, and then chart out what they need, and then they have to go out and do it on their own. And it's a little bit different because it's like a class. You go to the class and you get all the materials, you go home, it's really hard to digest and then go out and figure out what the next steps are. When you do the deep dive, we actually have a plan that is time-based, and you have homework, and we'll call you to check up on your homework. And some people you don't, right? So it's also that piece about developing something that makes sense, right, for someone. So it will keep Will on the ground and do some really deep dive. And generally, anyone who comes into a program for us, they stay on for at least a minimum of 3 years to actually see the fruit of the labor. So that's usually how long it takes to both clean credit, to access credit, to actually see your clients after the first 24 months. And then just so that you know, 20% of who we serve is non-Latino. That's one thing. And then no one actually gets turned away. So at a minimum, anyone who comes to the door will get at least an hour and a half assessment on a series of areas, and they leave with some level of direction with some plan. And we work with our resources. We work with Janet over there if it makes sense for them to go over there, and then some of our nonprofit partners like Share and others to get them the resources they need as part of a long-term plan.
So if you get half, 30 grand, will that still keep Will moving forward?
It will. I mean, for us, the important part here is to ensure that we have 52 people who are outside the city, and we're doing this for the city of Vancouver. 52 people that we have right now do not qualify for the city of Vancouver. 25 of those would greatly benefit from a deeper dive. They have innovative businesses, they have interesting ideas, they have passion, all the components that I think that with a deeper dive, with a deeper, you know, sort of focused plan, they would move forward. So, yes. And then whatever that was, we'll adjust it.
And you did not approach City of Vancouver for...
We're currently a recipient of the City of Vancouver. Through that work, the Latino community can't be called out. So even when I do outreach, it's on Univision, which will cover Seattle to La Pine, right? So the resources, whenever we do outreach, we'll get people from all over our region. Our Beaverton, we have also a similar project in the city of Beaverton. Our Beaverton person just got 5 people from Clark County who went out to see a class that she was giving at the Beaverton Library just because people are hungry for information and the resources and they can't get it. So they'll go across town to get it somewhere else. So the city of Vancouver has renewed this for 3 times. So we're going on our 4th year. So we're looking at 2018 funding. We do have a community foundation of Southwest Washington supported us last year, and we're returning for some support with that. And then we have the Northwest Health Foundation through Kaiser Permanente gave us a small grant. U.S. Bank has given us a few thousand dollars. So we're putting it all together. The work will go. I think our board is committed to making sure this work happens. We're just trying to make sure that as funding goes away in different areas, that we're keeping the momentum going.
So the reason it's not listed on the Vancouver column is because we don't consider it as a joint project, because they could fund just Clark County citizens or they could fund just Vancouver citizens.
Gotcha.
And one other thing, if I could share, we mentioned in our consolidated annual performance evaluation report to HUD last year that although Clark County has a 9% Hispanic population according to the census, with our CDBG funds, we serve 548 households in 2016 and zero were Hispanic. So HUD will be looking at that and how we are trying to make improvements on those numbers.
And regardless of what happens here, please reach out to us to help you with that reallocation. We have a, since 96, we have a scholarship program and we have an education IDA program and a couple of other components. So we're getting in the schools and we have live persons who actually are working with the school system to reach the parents. So if they, if we can sort of figure out who they are, it makes them easy to be able to get them to be served. So just whatever, what, no matter what happens, please use this as a resource to get into connection, to connect to this community. Can I stay and watch Jeanette? Thank you, guys.
Thank you. So you have a little more.
Next, we have a Greater Vancouver Chamber of Commerce appeal.
So Jonathan is going to be disappointed because Jeanette can't be with us this morning. She had a family medical emergency and is with her son over at Dornbecker Children's Hospital. Haven't heard the report. Hopefully everything will be fine. I am a, I'm it. I'm the stand-in.
Who are you?
and that's the only slide I came prepared to talk about. My name's John McDonough. I am the President and CEO of the Greater Vancouver Chamber of Commerce. Some of you may also know me from the Vancouver Business Journal. My brother and I have owned that for the last 12 years. I've been to visit with some of you about bringing these services to your communities. First, let me talk a bit about the Greater Vancouver Chamber. We're the largest business organization in Clark County. We have right at 1,100 members, and our members come from across the county. We have been a CDBG recipient through the City of Vancouver's funding. I think we started at the same time as the Hispanic Chamber and are now doing it for the 2018 funding cycle. We've had tremendous success, I would say. Jeanette would be able to speak specifically to those numbers. One of the greatest disappointments we've had is that two-thirds more of the people that we've actually been able to work with, while we've taken the call and visited with them, we haven't been able to help them because they've been outside the jurisdiction of the City of Vancouver. So with the City of Vancouver funding, either the applicant needs to be a resident or their business needs to be located within the city limits. So that two-thirds of the folks who have contacted us live and work outside the city limits, so we're unable to include them. We frequently refer them to the Hispanic Chamber because of the funding that they have and allows them to work with those businesses. So we're before you today because we'd like to work with as many of those as we can. We have a number of successes. Given Jonathan's experience with PowerPoint, though, I'm not going to even advance the slide. I think that's the right word is. With that, I would entertain any of the questions that you have. We're committed to bring the service to the county, and if the funding program here doesn't work, then we'll try and figure out a different way.
Do you know the dollar amount you get from Vancouver?
$55,000.
How many people are you contacting you annually for service?
So we're committed to the city of Vancouver to help 30 business people a year. I'll tell you that this is February 13th, and Jeanette already has 20 that she's working with for this calendar year.
Oh. So the other two-thirds you'd be serving, looking to serve another maybe 60 businesses?
Easily. So our small business assistance program is designed to work with anyone from pre-launch to in business for 2 or 3 years at the kitchen table or the garage and ready to maybe step into a brick and mortar situation. Jeanette frequently counsels people around their readiness and one of the things that we want to assure is that they don't start too quickly and then wind up in an unsustainable situation. So a number of the folks that will contact her, she'll say, you know, here are the things that need to be in place before we can even have a conversation. So as John said, you know, here's your homework. Go and take care of these things, then come back, and then we can have a conversation. Or they're in a situation where they've never prepared financial statements to even pursue a loan from a financial institution. So Jeanette will help with that. We work with a number of our clients on grant applications, on putting business plans together.
So this money would go toward a person? Where would the money go?
It would go to funding a business
person.
And it shouldn't go without saying, so I'll say it. In addition to the staff person that this would fund, come the resources of the Greater Vancouver Chamber. So none of the people in our small business assistance program are required to be members of the chamber, even though for the most part, chamber programming is for members. So none are required to be members of the chamber, and we afford them the opportunity for the workshops and various events that we have. Network to help them build their expertise in sustainability and business. So that's afforded as a part of participating.
Any other questions for John?
Any of the other details, just remember what John has told you.
Anytime you're ready, we're a little bit ahead of schedule, and we were just.
Sure.
Jared Sandberg with Lifeline Connections. Lifeline is a nonprofit organization based out of Vancouver. We have three locations. Our main campus is located in the Center for Community Health, over on off of Fort Plain in the main campus. We have a location in the Orchards area, and we have a location in campus. Lifeline has been around since 1962, behavioral health treatment organization. We're the largest provider of substance use disorder treatment in the region. When we were formed back in 1962, our original name was called the Clark County Council on Alcoholism. You can kind of see how that progressed over time and served more individuals and with more complex needs over the years. So right now we have inpatient programs for folks who have an addiction issue. We have mental health programs. We have programs that treat individuals that have both, which is all of our population has a mental health diagnosis and an addiction issue. And so we feel very, I think, very important place in our community. We serve about 4,000 individuals every year. We offer the only detox, the only inpatient residential program, the only sobering center in our community. One of our programs is our inpatient residential program. We have 44 beds. It's an adult program. It's a co-ed program. The average stay is about 30 days. And what we have found in that program is that mothers who have an addiction issue, who are pregnant or have little children, there are barriers for them to get into treatment. Because of those barriers, some don't seek out treatment. Some don't finish treatment, complete successfully. And so Lifeline's board of directors and staff has been looking for ways to treat this population in a more appropriate manner than we're doing right now. And one of the ways that we look to do that is starting a new inpatient program specifically for these women in our community. The closest one is up in Longview, and when you have transportation issues and you have young children, getting up to Longview can be difficult. So a residential treatment program for pregnant and parenting women is what we're, our hope is to start this program in our community. I talk about the services for mothers and children. So these programs are set up. They're inpatient. We're looking at a facility that will have 16 beds and that will also serve about 18 children. The program is set up to treat their substance use disorder. It's also set up to operate a therapeutic child care. So the child will be on site. The child will be engaged in similar treatment services, just like the mother. And we'll be treating the family. And the research has shown that's very effective in getting the outcomes that we want to see, which is sobriety, which is being self-sufficient, becoming productive members of our society. Talks about some of the things that we look at, doing help with them, secure housing, employment, transportation, type of child care, parenting classes, all those kind of things that go into what our goal is with these women. So why now? I kind of talk about the barriers that we're seeing as a provider of the largest inpatient program in our community. We are experiencing across the nation and in Clark County an opioid epidemic. Opioid epidemic. So people being addicted to pain pills, heroin. Clark County is not exempt from that. Of all the people we serve, the primary drug of choice is opioids, pain pills, or heroin. We're seeing younger kids. Some have maybe might be an illegitimate pain injury that turns into an addiction. Some not. So we have this problem in our community. We have young women who are struggling with this addiction. And then pregnancy happens, and then there's a baby involved. So our proposed project is to renovate some space in this building. This is a space that's off the Fourth Plain and across from Falk Road. It's currently used by Janus Youth and Daybreak Youth Services. Daybreak Youth Services is moving out of this space, and so their space will be available. And so we're looking at their space, and we're looking at a build out to get this space available for this type of program. So we need some capital. We need some capital to get this space available for the living and to make it a good job here. So the building is actually owned by Janus Youth. Lifeline and Janus have a good relationship. We worked closely over the years, and they're very supportive of the idea of us opening this type of program in the other half of their space. What we need done, so I kind of talked about there's some cosmetic things we need done. The building is currently used for a 16-bed program for adolescent boys, so as you can imagine, the building is in better days, it's a little worn and torn. So we need to go in there.
So what do you say?
Yes. if you have adolescent boy, you know. So we need to go in there. We need to pick new carpet. We need to paint. Cosmetic stuff. But more importantly, we also need to get ready for these women and children. So we need to build out a portion of it to make it ready for child care. So there's some plumbing that needs to be involved. There's some moving of some walls, some other things that we need to make sure that this program is suitable for the population we're seeking to serve, and make sure it can pass inspection. The program needs to be licensed by not only the Department of Health, it needs to be licensed by the Department of Early Learning to operate a child care. So they have their requirements that they need to see met. So we need to, so that's kind of goes into what we need to have done. So self-sustaining, we're looking for some capital costs to get the program up and running. But once the program is up and operational, the current rates sustain the program, the current operating revenue sustain the program. Talk about some of these programs throughout the state, 36 programs statewide, 92 obtained their state, 92% obtained funding to sustain their program, so there's ongoing funding for these programs to make them operational and to keep them whole.
Through the state?
Through the state. So this is funded in Medicaid. Most of these women, all of these women, are low income. Will be funded through Medicaid. But of course, Medicaid will cover capital costs and it's going to cover the service that we provide. So that's why we're here to ask for that support for the capital costs. As you can imagine, a Medicaid, state, even federal, have earmarked this population as a priority population. Easy to see why. Treat mothers typically that reverses the cycle of addiction that sometimes we see in families. That can also help reverse intergenerational poverty that we see. So, really when you treat the mothers and the women, it really has a real impact on families and our community at large. Talk about that return on investment that I just kind of mentioned. When we invest in providing treatment to mothers and children who are in need of addiction treatment, you can kind of see the return on investment. For a dollar invested, a little under $4 in benefits for pregnant women, about $5.61. So it's definitely a return on investment. Investing in these programs is great. And that, of course, translates into less time for these mothers, possibly incarcerated, less time on public assistance, less time in the emergency department. There's all these benefits when we get these mothers effective treatment when they need it. It really is a cost saver, and for my opinion, more importantly, it saves families. So even if it didn't cost, even if the return of investment was low, I would still be supported because it saves families. We talked about the importance of engaging the mother. I'll talk about kind of the child and the impact of that has on our society. So for an untreated mother, the harm to the child are great. We talked about how that cycle of poverty, that cycle of addiction tends to be generational for a lot of families. The impact on the child. So when they're not given, when they're not provided, when the mother's not treated, when they're not provided the treatment they need as well. That's what the benefit of these programs, we're not just engaging the mother, we're engaging the child as well, because we're just having any treatment. So when a child's not given the support they need, hearing problems, 4 times as high. So, family does not have these issues. Vision problems, 8 times as high. Learning problems, 50 to 100% as high. So that's our proposal for our residential treatment program for pregnant and caring women. Questions? We're asking for $125,000 for the county and $75,000 for the city for a total of $200,000 from the CPP. Part of that is we will need about $500,000 on our current estimates to fill out the space, so we're relying on private plans to be another revenue as well to kind of bring us forward.
Since you don't own the building, you have some sort of an agreement so that you'll be able to utilize the remodel facilities for a long period of time?
So in our application, there was a letter from the executive director, Janice Youth, stating that he was aware of the project, he's supportive of the project, and supportive of a long-term lease to Lifeline Connections. So yes, I have no concern that that space will not be available to meet our needs for as long as that building is there.
And that would be a CDBG requirement too.
Let me touch base, as indicated, with Janice, and they're willing to take on a deed or a lien as necessary by the, as required by the program.
So if you only get half from Vancouver and half from us, does the project go on? Or
the project goes on, it's just money. Our hope is that our funding lines up, we can look at opening this program next fall. Maybe maybe early 2018. But if funding doesn't line up, that just means we'll have to find other sources of funding, and that just delays the opening of this program. Well, we are, as an organization, are committed to this program. That just might take longer for us to secure funding.
So,
so
the county council is also a part of the Board of Health, and we've recently had a report from Dr. Mellon at Public Health about syphilis and other types of pregnancy-related births. Issues. It makes me think that there's probably some connection here with this drug abuse and addictive situation with pregnant women and targeted behaviors. I just wonder if there's a connection there that you can see. So we see the opportunity here, but maybe there are other opportunities for saving mothers and babies. And
I think as we treat these adults, we find out that they need a whole range of rescue. And so typically when we come in and treat the behavioral health issue, we really treat a whole range of issues and reduce the harm that they're causing themselves and to the child, and that could be from STDs or what have you.
So we're having two separate conversations in my mind, I think.
Yeah, there's definitely overlap.
Do you know what your anticipation is of the need, or do you already have those figures?
We look at our 16-bed program. That program will not have an issue keeping its beds full, and more than likely you will have a waiting list to get into the program.
Is there a service of this going on right now? Do you do that?
The closest one is in Longview, Washington. So, for example, in our 44-bed adult program, we average anywhere between a 2 to 3 week waiting list to get into that program. And that's just for adults co-ed without children. So the issue will always be capacity.
Well, is there another program right now that's serving this need that's in this area?
No.
Or is it just in Longview?
Just in Longview. There is not a similar program serving the need.
How many beds do they have?
They have 16 as well.
And
they are full.
All the time.
Yep.
Questions?
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
instead of these folks talking about their project, Fred talks about their project for 5 minutes, and then they have 5 minutes to answer questions or add a little tidbit, but still just 5 minutes.
My comments are very obvious as possible. In this case, the single family.
Okay, well, then we should call
and then we can email out your reports to all the board members.
I had some additional comments.
I didn't know that it worked out.
It's fine that I was trying to save or something.
I look at that thing on the draw slide.
That's perfect because I was thinking,
Rats,
we forgot to bring photocopies of this report, but now it looks like it's.
Well, yeah. It is minor stuff, but anyway, it'll be in the full. You'll get
okay,
that
then
in
we'll
a day
just
or two.
So thank
that's,
you.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking. What type of sit-down is possible?
Oh yeah, we should have switched those around.
Yeah.
But at one point we thought
Crowd's
ground
would
be also
a good either. I'd love to switch the dog park.
So we'll switch them around.
That's my first.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
Just gonna ask that Sam.
Does it tell us what
the availability of where?
Work. You know, it's gonna get you started.
We're gonna start in about 1 minute.
You know, work's gonna get you. Bony papers.
Hopefully I have, yeah, if I don't do it now, I'm going to have way too much to do this at the end of the day.
Honestly, it's a mess, but I'm doing my best. So, yeah, there's a lot of problems, but I'm working my way through them. There's just a lot of them. But when you don't have a director for a year, you know,
Fred, we're going to start with
Crowd's
Ground.
That's the biggest problem.
That's tough.
Do you mind if I start?
All right, we're going to get started. So good morning. I said we'd start with Habitat, but I lied. We're going to start with Trout Ground, just because it made more sense in terms of some analysis presentation we're going to have for Habitat and for Reef.
Hi, so my name is Katie Ulrich, and I'm the homeownership program director at Proud Ground. And Proud Ground is a nonprofit that started in 1999, and our main mission is to create permanently affordable homeownership opportunities for moderate income, first time homebuyers. So, starting off the homeownership. So, you know, the crisis that we've seen in the rental market has really highlighted the need for middle-income families with, so it's really highlighted the need for middle-income families that have stable incomes to move into homeownership. Homeownership for families is really stability. Renters have fear of displacement, obviously, as we know from rising rent increases, as well as no-cause evictions. And so the benefits that they get from homeownership is really kind of percolates throughout the community and in their lives. We have one of the things that I passed out there was on one side it says why homeownership, and it actually summarizes a study we did of our homeowners last year, and there is the full, actually, report is a document as part of our application, but basically it showed that our homeowners did find improvement in employment, health improvements. They attributed the improvements of their kids in school, not having to take their kids in and out of different schools, to their status as a homeowner. So when we see the homeownership, we really have seen that it benefits not just the families, but and also the communities. Many of them are getting more involved in their communities after they've purchased a home as well. So homeownership sounds like it's a good thing for households that are ready to move into homeownership. Well, we obviously, all right, it's just going to do teasers, I guess. It's okay. Hopefully know the routine back and forth. So the Clark County median income is about $48,000 a year. A family earning $48,000 a year could qualify for a traditional mortgage of about $160,000. And that assumes that they don't have a lot of their own money to bring in for the down payment, which, as we know, can be hard to save for, especially with the rental costs going up. Well, recently, the median sales price in Clark County was close to $290,000. It increased 9% last year alone. So I don't need to, like, lay it out for you, but there's a large group of middle-income households in Clark County that where homeownership just isn't really an option for them anymore. So, and I'll point out here on this site too, I mean, I think we brought this last year, this is part of the report we did, but this is pretty traditional over the years that incomes don't increase at the same rates that housing costs do. So we have to find a way to make sure that there's opportunity for these households to move into homeownership. All right, so, I've got to let it go too. All right, so the flip side of the handout is actually a more detailed layout of our request. But I thought I'd just give that to you as a takeaway and make it a little bit more simple here with some visuals. So what our program does, we have a buyer-initiated program that we've actually gotten funded, thankfully, in the last 3 years in Clark County. And we work with, income qualified home buyers. So we work closely with the Community Housing Resource Center to identify mortgage ready, income qualified, first time home buyers. And they go out and they get qualified for their traditional mortgage, one that they can afford. In this example, it's $175,000 mortgage. And then the CDBG or home funds and Proud Ground contributes $10,000 to each of these homes of our own funds. Becomes the buyer's down payment. So they're now able to go out shopping on the open market for an existing home for sale of about $250,000. That's what this example is. All right. So the exciting thing, I think, about how our program works and what makes it a little bit different is that these homes, once they are purchased, become a permanent community asset for Clark County. The homes that are brought into this program, we ensure that they remain affordable resale after resale to another income-qualified family. And we steward that whole process. So this home and these stocks of home will never need additional subsidy to keep them affordable to future households. This is achieved through a legal agreement that we sign with our homeowners at closing that we fully, you know, educate them on. They get legal review of that as well prior to closing. And basically, the agreement gives the family a fair return on their investment in the property while still keeping it affordable to another family behind them. All right. So Proud Ground, I said where it came around 1999. We've actually served 335 homeowners region-wide. And we are, we have 265 permanently affordable homes and have never lost a home to foreclosure. And our organization is structured in a way to make sure that our homeowners have a voice in our organization. So our organizational bylaws require that we get votes from our homeowners if we're doing certain things like changing our bylaws or changing our selling piece of land, We also have one-third of our board of directors has to be current homeowners at all times. So it's a nice way to have that balance in our organizational structure. All right. So I'll tell you this information as I go to the next slide because I think it makes more sense just to look at this cute family. So we have served 7 households so far in Southwest Washington, and the median family income of those 7 households was $46,000 a year. They worked at, one was a local pastor. We also had someone worked at a local IT company. I mean, these are just average working families. And we have 20, with our work in Southwest Washington over the last 3 years, we've actually established a list of about 21 households that are on our applicant list and waiting for an opportunity to purchase a home in Clark County. So, I can also give steps. I have another little, and then I'll open up for questions, but just wanted to let you know, we are currently administering CDBG funds. We have assisted one family in already purchasing a home, and we have 2 other home buyers out there shopping right now in the market. One is focused in Camas, that's where they currently rent and want to stay, and the other family is looking in Ridgefield. So we're very hopeful that we will be getting other properties. So, this guy looks like he has questions. What about you?
What's your region? When you say a region, what is your region?
Right, so we serve the Portland metro region. We serve all the way from Clackamas County, Multnomah, Washington, and Clark County as well.
But of course, these funds can only be used in Clark County.
Right, yes.
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 I understand.
And I know that's part of the requirements, but we obviously, all of the home buyers that are served through this program would be required to be Clark County residents, not in the city of Vancouver, as well as the property that they purchased.
How many homes have you done in Clark County?
7 so far, and we have funding right now to do 2 more this in 16-17 funding.
Are these asked to fund 6 more, is that correct?
So, good question. The ask is actually, so what we had applied both for home and CDBG. I know there's lots of competition. Our anticipation is that we will hopefully be funded for 3. And I think there's flexibility in looking at whether CDBG or home is the right fit for our program. We are not a certified CHOTO, but I think that we would qualify based upon our board having representation from our homeowners. I think in the past we've only applied for CDBG, but this year with the home funds being a little bit more available, we thought that might open up flexibility to fund more in CDBG and allow us to use home funds. And I will thank you for pointing that out. The ask of the home funds is a little bit higher than the ask of the CDBG funds, and that was really just based more strategically on what was available. If we are able to get more, I mean, as you saw in my example, the sales price of the home was about $250,000, but the median is $290,000. So I think any little bit that we can get in addition would help us, A, either serve a family at a little bit lower income or allow a household to purchase in more of like a higher opportunity area where the prices might be a little bit higher.
What's your average home save of a homeowner? So they buy the home and then how long do they stay before they move on to something else?
Good question. So we have had in our 17 years about 60 families resell out of 335 families we've helped. So our homeowners actually stay. Yeah, but on average, I would say they're selling every 7 to 10 years, just like any other average first-time home buyer.
And then there's some sort of guaranteed return on investment where they've got a little bit of equity that they can roll into something else
right.
later, but not 100% of what was given as a down payment?
Right, right. So what happens through that formula and what keeps it affordable, the home buyer that purchased that house that we saw for $250,000, for example, their contribution was $175,000, right? The family actually pays $175,000. When they sell their home, they could get that $175,000 plus 25% of any change in value that's happened on the home while they've lived there. So they get everything they put into it, plus all of the principal buy down of their home loan, and 25% of the increase in value.
Having sold a house at a loss, so houses don't always go up.
Right, right.
So do they eat 25% of the loss?
Yep, it's the same formula in a gain or depreciation. And I think the benefit really is that they don't see that full 100% decrease in the appreciation that's lost. And many families, if that happens, they've actually, and we have had it happen. I mean, we were here throughout. But they buy, you know, you have to, the simple math just of, despite appreciation of what happens in our housing market, just getting a family from renting into owning and having them have stable monthly payments that pay down the principal on their loan, they are better able to cushion any potential losses. And we have, you know, zero homes lost to foreclosure. We do provide post-purchase services to our households. We have... We work closely with other community resources to connect them to make sure they're successful in their promotion.
How do they find you?
Good question. So we have a pretty tight partnership with the Community Housing Resource Center in Vancouver that does do first-time homebuyer education and counseling. And so many of our homebuyers have come through that. They offer like an 8-hour HUD-approved first-time home buyer education class that is required of all of our homeowners. And so many of them are through there. We also are working with different groups here in Clark County, the Clark County Asset Building Coalition and Council for the Homeless, trying to really connect with, you know, the home buyers we work with are employees of nonprofits. They're employees of, you know, they're basically working and connected with the community already. So we've also done some outreach with some churches in the area as well.
And I want to keep us on schedule.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions?
My name is Fred Dockweiler. I was asked by Michael and Samantha to do a review of the two home projects, one being the Evergreen Habitat for Humanity project and the other being the Reach Isabella Court Phase 2. I'm going to start with the Evergreen Habitat for Humanity. I think then we'll hear from those folks and then I'll go into the Reach project. So Evergreen Habitat for Humanity has come in to request $100,000 in home funds to assist in the acquisition of four lots and ultimately the construction of four single-family homes in Clark County. The total cost of those homes, those four homes, will be about $600,000, which equates to about $150,000 a home, which I think everybody would agree is a pretty reasonable amount for those four homes. The target income set aside, if you will, is 30 to 60% AMI. So if you look at, I did a quick calculation, if you assume that $150,000 home, 0% mortgage over 30 years, that payment equates to about $417 a month. You add taxes and insurance to that, and then compare that to the low home rental amount at 60% of $955. I think we'd all agree that that's certainly well inside those set-aside limits. I think the only other comment that I'll make on this particular application is we've understood they're wrapping up the build-out of the McKibben Commons 10-lot subdivision, so the home funding may not be a 2017 funding. It may not be necessary to be funded until 2018. Any questions based on the quick overview? I will tell you, too, that I will... through Samantha and Michael, I'll get you guys a full report to review at some point before you make a decision on this project.
So you get half, two lots are bought, the other two are?
We have Evergreen here as well to answer those questions.
Right.
You can join the table, I guess.
Do you want us to do our presentation first or do questions first?
Let's just do the questions and then you guys can, is that okay?
Yeah.
Or does your presentation answer the questions?
I might answer some of them. I don't know what all the questions are.
If you knew that, you wouldn't have come.
That's right. Yeah.
Thanks for that.
Goal that drives all of its programs, and that's creating a community where everyone has a decent place to live. And we do that by partnering with low and moderate income families and for affordable home ownership. So we sell homes to families with a 0% interest mortgage through a process where they help us build and construct the home. We've been doing this in Clark County since 1991 and have built 35 homes to date. And because our construction process is majority volunteer-led, we provide over 500 volunteer experiences annually. As many of you are aware, we're having a housing problem here in our community. We've got very low vacancy rates for rental units. Wait lists for public assistance are closed. Voucher systems are closed. And cost of units continues to increase. This causes stress on both low and middle income families, causing them to pay huge percentages of their income towards their housing costs. The Department of Housing and Urban Development recommends that families not pay over 30% of their income towards their housing costs, and we see families paying over 30 and even over 50% of their income, which doesn't leave room for much else. Habitat's solution to this problem is through affordable home ownership. This is a permanent solution for families. Families are no longer at the mercy of their landlords. They have a 30-year mortgage at 0% interest through Habitat, and they go through the whole process of building a home, of going through a couple classes to really ready themselves for home ownership. As was mentioned a few minutes ago, we're currently building out our McKibben Commons site, and that should be completed by early to mid 2018. So in order to decrease likelihood of having a lull in our construction, we'll be looking for property and then using the home funds to build four units in a property that is undetermined. And the exact project goals, which is to build 4 units in Clark County to sell to 4 families who have gone through a home ownership program, as well as to provide 400 volunteer opportunities through the course of the building of 4 homes, and then use the home funding to gather more support from other agencies and organizations in the community. Habitat acts as a key piece of the local housing continuum. Many of our families come through other housing agencies, so they're coming out of transitional and subsidized units into a permanent affordable home that is then theirs over the course of a 30-year mortgage. And then because we are the holders of the mortgage, each of the payments, the monthly mortgage payments of our homeowners, are then funneled back into the community to build more homes, which we call the Fund for Humanity. And then expanding our build locations, building in the county, then expands the knowledge because of our volunteer program about the affordable housing crisis and what we're doing to combat that. And I'll open up to questions.
Okay. So if you only get 50 grand instead of 100, you buy 2 lots and the other 2 are just Lake Fallow, or what's the deal?
No, so we actually have 2 different properties right now that we're looking at as potential donations to our affiliate. I can't disclose what they are because those donors haven't finalized those intentions. One of them will be a 10-lot development, the other one will be about 20-home development. So our hope is that all of this money will go towards home construction and not towards acquisition. Yeah. We would have applied for enough home funds for 10 lots, but it's a very competitive process, so we kept it low enough, we hope we can get some funds.
Yeah. Now, how does your program work when the property owner 10 years later wants to sell the property?
Yeah, absolutely. So similar to Proud Ground, we have protections built into the deed. So most of our homes right now, we have a first mortgage, which is their affordable mortgage. We set all of their mortgage prices at 30% of their income. So they're only ever making 30% of their income as payments. Then if that is not the appraised value, we do a silent second mortgage, which we forgive over time. That would make it up to the difference to the appraised value. The most important thing is that we have a protection on the appreciation, because a lot of times homes appreciate quite rapidly, especially if you're selling them at discounted cost with 0% interest. So we have an appreciation clause that for the first 5 years they get all of their equity, but they get 0% appreciation. From 5 to 10 years they get 25% of the appreciation. 10 to 15 years they get 50%, and it goes on from there. Most of our homeowners stay in the house. I think in the last 10 years we've had one homeowner sell. They had gotten a better job, their family had grown, they started their own business and decided we want to build our own house and have a larger house than they were. They had 7 kids at that time, so they were ready to move on. Yeah, that, to us, that's a sign of success. Yeah.
So that equity then goes back to your program?
Correct.
So that additional equity to the company, then you get your share?
Yeah, depending on the rules with the home funds. I mean, we have home funds from the county back from like 2003, 2004. Those have different clauses about what would be repaid back to the county and reinvested into future home
grants.
Yeah.
So, like this 10 lot development.
Yeah.
Are there HOA agreements on all these developments?
There will be. Yeah, that's within city limits. It's down by Highway 14 in Leaser. We have 7 of those homes under construction right now. Actually, 6 from there and 1 other on the county. The other 4 will start in September. So
there will be an HOA,
there will be an HOA
for standards and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's our largest development to date. You know, if you looked at us 5 years ago, we only had 2 and a half staff members. Now we have 8 staff, and we've gone from building 1 home every year or so to this year we're doing 10 homes. It's quite the leap, but we're excited about it. And it, you know, if you go back to that Fund for Humanity thing, those 10 homes, those homeowner payments, those principal payments are coming back to us and helping us build the next 10 or 15 homes. So it's helping us build more capacity each year.
Is there an average size of the home?
Yeah, we have strict design criteria from Habitat International, which is based in Atlanta, Georgia. So our average home, a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, would be 1,200 square feet. So we build simple, decent, affordable. They're not custom designed homes. We are doing most of our homes now as universal design for accessibility standards. So that's added a little bit to the size just with increased hallway sizes and door sizes, but not too much.
What's the average cost of
Average cost
of like the volunteer labor and this.
Yeah, average cost of construction right now is about $105, not including land. Land is always the X factor of can we find something that's donated or do we have to spend $80,000 for a single lot?
Right.
Yeah.
Any other questions before we move on to reach?
Great. We'd welcome you all to come out and volunteer anytime.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so the second project that I'll talk about, been a long morning, is phase two of Isabel Court with Reach. They were in last year and were awarded $250,000, and they've come back in for another $250,000 in home funds for a couple of reasons. Number one, to support, show local support for their tax credit application with the state of Washington right now. But I think as well, the tax credit equity market, for those of you that understand tax credits and how that's gone recently with our latest presidential election, has been in a little bit of discord. So the $250,000 helps them close a gap in the project funding to a certain extent. These 49 units, which, you know, again, is phase two, located just off of Fourth Plain, will serve seniors 62 and older in either the 30 or 50% AMI cohort. They've also secured a 30-unit project-based voucher agreement with Vancouver Housing. So they've got that in place to help folks that are have very low income seniors in the project. The other thing that I would mention, two things, I guess. Number one is, their per cost of just over $270,000 a unit is in excess of the typical home funding requirements, but I believe that they've probably applied for and received a waiver for that from the state, which would be applicable to this program. And then the last thing that I would mention is that the first phase of this project, which is a like 49 unit project, is already 82% either applied for or occupied in terms of applicants for those units, and they received their certificate of occupancy in mid-December. I, in a prior life, was involved in a lot of senior housing development, and seniors take a while to move, so the fact that 45 days in, they're at 82% leased and under application is a pretty good sign that this second phase will be successful as well.
Why
does
it cost so high?
Well, certainly the cost for these senior projects and doing a single building costs just in general have been escalating. I think they can probably talk a little bit more about some of that. I mean, this project and the, you know, again, they will receive home funds last year. Costs today are certainly not the same costs that there were last year and the year before that.
That's $12 million, right?
Actually, $13
million
for 49.
And
that's not, unfortunately, that's just not atypical in this day and age. The biggest thing, honestly, is not so much the raw materials that we're seeing, it's the labor. Getting contractors and doing those things is very difficult, and that's really been the biggest escalation and cost factor that I've seen.
Obviously, you have elevators too.
Yeah, you will in a senior deal for sure. A lot of common area too, so they get places to hang out and socialize.
They're all built for seniors.
I'm sorry, sir.
They're all built for seniors, so.
Correct. There's
people like Philip can get in there and they have handholds and.
I hope.
As long as you're 62 or older.
I hope.
Yeah. there'll be a restriction on that in terms of age. There's no other questions. I'll let Reach make their presentation. Thank you.
starts off. Fred did a good job of kind of giving us a highlight. I don't think we'll go too far into too much of this. A lot of this information is stuff we presented last year. I'll just go through some of the highlights of the changes. We know we're out of limited time. We have the same project team here. Screech Housing Development Center is our owner's rep. Our architect is MWA and Team Construction. We're still at 49 units given our maximizing our density on the site we're on. We have added 10 accessible units for folks with disabilities. Seniors hadn't been in this round with the Washington State Department of Commerce the highest priority like they've been in past years, partly because of how the state does its own planning. And so we really addressed that and were able to get funding this year by making a special set aside for folks with disabilities. And we know there's a lot of crossover between seniors and folks with, in particular, physical disabilities. And so I'll get into why the cost is relatively high compared to maybe other projects you have. The accessibility and added accessibility of this project is part of that. We're also doing energy efficient apartments. There's ERVs in every unit. Really, this great site now that the Vine is open and we have bus rapid transit nearby. Here's the site itself, taken several months ago during construction on the first phase. Part of also the added cost is that we're doing quite a bit of stormwater work on a higher site, doing some sewer pumping. There's easements involved with all these sites. And that site is actually lower than the site on phase one. So we have some retaining walls, things like that we've added. Just relatively speaking, I know a lot of you know this area fairly well. We're just north of Fort Plain Boulevard, just south of SR 500 and between I-5 and I-205, and really excited by the transit-oriented development that we really now have with added Vine stations that have come about. Since we were here last year, this was really the first money in. With the award that we got from the county, we were able to then leverage it and get another award from the City of Vancouver of $100,000. We had put in an application in April to the Vancouver Housing Authority of the 30 project-based vouchers. That actually triggered federal prevailing wage. When you go over, I believe it's 9 project-based vouchers. We had federal prevailing wage on the first phase. Part of that was all the home dollars in the deal. We also have state prevailing wage on those particular classifications that are uncovered by the federal that are higher. So between those two things, the labor costs are even higher than a project in a conventional market. We then submitted a housing trust fund application to Commerce, Department of Commerce, in September. We were happy to find out in an 8-to-1 oversubscribed year at the state that we were funded at the $2.1 million request we needed. And a lot of that will come with home funds from the state that will have home units in addition to Clark County's and the cities. In the same time as we were going through all this, we also were finishing construction of phase one that did happen in November. As Fred mentioned, we've been going through lease up right now. We had a pre-application process for phase two for this project here with the City of Vancouver in December to kind of help refine some of our design ideas. Found out later, a few weeks later, that we were funded at the state. And then we submitted a 9% low-income housing tax credit application to the Housing Finance Commission just a few weeks ago. And Jessica, when she comes up, we'll talk a little bit about where we're at today because we know we submitted this presentation to you before we know some more information from the state. Same unit mix, we're looking at 46 one-bedrooms and 3 two-bedrooms, replicating a lot of the things that we've done on phase one's design to really save money more than anything, especially since we're using the same architect this time around. Transit-oriented site, we're adding community gardens on this phase. There are already 12 sort of planters for community gardens in the first phase. This one will have a fitness room, the other did not, so both properties together could use the benefit of the fitness room, whereas there'll be a community room on the first phase. The management office is on the first phase as well, and that courtyard towards the north end of the property will be shared between both properties to really just maximize the site. This gives you a better sense of when we submitted the application to Clark County and what's been going on. The sources I talked about, the county and the city funds, you can see our low-income housing tax credit equity is at that 95 cents, which is part of the lower, we were at $1.05, for instance, on phase one. That 10 cent hit is what you've seen since the election. It still fluctuates day to day. Everyone's kind of talking corporate tax reform, and you know, until anything gets passed at the federal level, it's all a little speculation at this point. That Commerce Award of $2.1 million is factored in. Washington Community Reinvestment Association perm loan was really when we had that tax credit equity gap of $1 million, we talked to them about a permanent loan. They're about 5.5% interest right now. This $250,000 will help put a dent into that large perm loan that we're currently carrying with them to really get us to the point where we can move forward with the project with no gap. Just want to quickly touch again, I know last year I spoke a little bit more about the costs and the needs. We're still at 637 households in Clark County that are paying more than, senior households, that are paying more than 50% of their income or more for rent currently. So those are really the target market we're looking to do in this project. We had some 60% units in phase one. We're going even lower to both 30 and 50% on this particular phase. As we went and applied for all these sources, we had another market study update. Really just shows that there hasn't been much senior rent-restricted properties in the entire county, let alone multifamily rent-restricted properties really in the last 8 years. That's what our market study update told us. So it's not a whole lot of comps out there. There's just a whole lot of needs that we're really seeing. And a vacancy rate under 1%. So in addition to that, limited supply, rising rents, we know about the cost burden, the accessibility we're really trying to deal with, particularly here for folks with disabilities that are seniors, and adding those 10 accessible units, and then also having a property that's 100% adaptable, reinforcement in all the bathroom showers, ag grab bars, that kind of thing, and really feeling like that transit-oriented piece will be great for seniors to be close by. So those 30 units of the project-based vouchers targeted at 30% AMI and below, the rest at 50. Those folks that are in those project-based vouchers are really paying $412 on average, depending on where their income falls, and the rest is the subsidy from the Vancouver Housing Authority. And the 50% rent ranges are at $637 for one bedroom and $762 for two bedrooms, not including utilities. On the last slide, I mean, why now? Obviously, there's a huge crisis in the community, both in Vancouver and Clark County. We have site control now, as you can see on the southern portion, and that was the first phase. Just talking about mobilization savings, to do this project and move forward in a quick time really saves us quite a bit on architectural. Over 56,000 to not have to do zone change and move on a design that we've already done on phase one. And drive aisle work, utility work, everything that we've done on phase one really benefits phase two. That's over $250,000 of savings. It makes a whole lot of sense to not have to mobilize and create another project and really just build off of what we did on the first phase, flip it over, do a common courtyard, and really move forward to address the need here. It keeps us on schedule that we can begin to do construction in 2017. You never know with interest rates and everything else that's changing in this market how that will affect a project in 2018 when we have to go in for credits, whatever else it will be in the future, let alone carrying costs on the land, and just leveraging that amount of money and equity and state money and the city of Vancouver's money at a time where, you know, they will also have a property tax levy coming available. We really feel like this is a good time to really chomp and take advantage of that. I'm going to break Jessica.
Be very brief. So we just wanted to let you know what we know today about our state level funding. So we did this year, as Fred sort of mentioned, there's a lot of turmoil in our federal tax credit market that funds most multifamily affordable housing. But we do know that we have 9% tax credits. What we don't know yet is how everything is falling out with all of the state level projects. So we're working closely with the Finance Commission, the Department of Commerce, and the Vancouver Housing Authority, working on how in this uncertain market we can make sure that this project moves forward on its current timeline. We are very optimistic right now that we are prepared to do that, and just wanted to note that in addition to our state partners, REACH, our board of directors, and senior management are prepared to make sure that that we keep it going. So the $250,000 that we requested, again, just really helps us keep that momentum to move forward, given the loss of tax credits.
Great.
We're
ready for questions.
I just have one. Can you go back and talk about why those projects triggered prevailing wage?
Yep. I was talking really mainly here, the 30 project-based vouchers, you trigger it when you hit nine. We actually had...
And that's federal?
Federal.
And state, or are they different?
So good question. The commerce money, I think, gets triggered no matter when you take a dollar of commerce money. You have state prevailing wage. So what happens, and they do surveys about which one's higher. We're paying whichever one's higher. In most cases, it's the federal one. On the first phase, we had at least 17 home units. Those get triggered 12 or more.
So when you already have it, it's oftentimes good to take on subsidies. Like in addition, it helps your project, it helps your revenues, and if you're already taking construction cost estimates at the higher wage rates, you might as well take all the other resources you can, because nothing else will trigger it in addition. Makes sense. And just to adjust the cost, so not only state federal wage rates, the elevator is a big piece of it. And then subcontractor pricing, this market, I don't know how many folks have gone up into estimates, is going up 20-30% per year. We're just trying to manage that the best we can. We're doing it here locally. We do use team construction. They're using local subs. We do feel like that's benefiting the community here. Doesn't mean it doesn't come at a cost per year.
How many parking spaces will there be?
Good question.
One for a senior project like this one, one space per unit. We're adding in a few additional disability spots in there. So we have about 53.
So are there streets around? Because obviously more cars up per person than one.
Correct.
We'll say. I have six. will there be street parking?
Oh, there is street parking on 62nd. I mean, we do see less car ownership on seniors in particular, 62 and over. That's partly why we looked at a site near all this bus rapid transit, but you're right. I mean, we can definitely accommodate one per unit there with a few additional ones, but there is adequate street parking on both sides of the street on 62nd. Any questions? Thank you again.
We do
appreciate your support, Pat.
Thank you.
Thank you. And next we have Community Services Northwest.
Today we are here applying for $250,000 for our Clark Homeless Engagement Collaboration, or CHECK as we like to call it. So last week I was at a meeting where the Housing Solutions Center shared that they currently have about 500 households in their rapid rehousing priority pool. So for those of you who don't speak housing jargon, rapid rehousing programs are designed to target individuals who are literally and chronically homeless and then just have a few barriers to obtaining their own housing. Things such as lack of finances, poor credit history, maybe a past eviction or two. So our program, the Clark Homeless Engagement Collaboration, is targeting these individuals specifically. With the $250,000 over the course of 12 months, we will provide short-term rental assistance to about 15 to 20 households per month with the aim of assisting 50 unique households over the course of the 12 months. Additionally, we are applying for $50,000 from the CDBG funds for case management. So these funds will help provide one full-time case manager for all the participants in our program to help them assist in getting connected to education, employment, or other community resources that are appropriate for their needs. With the intensive case management, we hope to have the participants in the program receive the short-term rental assistance for 3 to 6 months and then be able to turn around and self-sustain on their own after that. Community Services Northwest is well positioned to implement this kind of program. We have over 10 years of supported housing experience, currently execute 50 subsidies for other various programs, and additionally, we are a landlord ourselves. We have 3 properties comprising 13 rental units, so we understand the concerns and needs of the landlords that we're working with. So we work to build and maintain those relationships with private landlords so we can help not only locate and obtain housing for the participants in our program, but also so that they can maintain on their own. Additionally, the case management will work with the individuals on budgeting and finances so that the reasons that they are coming into homelessness or that have caused their homelessness before will be prevented in the future. I will be happy to answer any questions that you guys have.
The 3 buildings you own, or the 3, where are they located?
Oh, we have 3 different units, or 3 different buildings. So we have a triplex, a fourplex, and then a kind of a group home, shared living environment that are not connected to these vouchers that we're requesting.
They're located
where? Oh, sorry. They are located on the Mill Plain and Fourth Plain and then 72nd, I believe.
So none really out in the county?
No, primarily within the city limits.
Is there a limit to the time that you have a rental assistance?
So the rental assistance would be for a max of 12 months, but our aim is to shorten that for between 3 to 6 months for quick turnaround so we can get the most bang for the buck on the course of the 12 months, serving as many households as we can.
How many households typically do you serve in a year?
It depends on the program. So we have various programs. We have some permanent supportive housing for folks that are kind of indefinite, as long as we help them. Previously, when we had rapid rehousing program, we served about 40 individuals.
So your case management, for lack of a better term, are firefighters. So if something comes up, they're the ones that try to come between the landlord and the tenant and try to douse the...
Absolutely. We try to work on that ahead of time. So when a participant comes into the program, we start, of course, we need to find housing and help them work with landlords and communicate and be able to get past that approval process. But then before those fires come up, we're working on preventative measures. So helping them get into employment resources or education, or if there's other community supports that we can get them involved in. Of course, we can't require participation, but we strongly encourage all the individuals that we're working with so that those fires don't come up and we can prevent them from happening.
Kind of backlog you got?
Backlog, as in?
How many people are lined up?
Yes. So with the coordinated entry in our county, we don't address the backlog necessarily. So most individuals who are in need of housing assistance go to the Housing Solutions Center first, and they are screened based on what their needs are and kind of placed in that priority pool of which program would best suit their needs. So we don't have the backlog ourselves. When we have program openings, we let the Housing Solutions Center know, and then the people that they have waiting are directed towards us. So thankful for programs like HSC, so we don't address that.
Actually, Jeff, this is the first year that we're requiring all of the TIBRA applicants that if they're going to get the rent assistance dollars, they are going to use the Housing Solutions.
And Housing Solutions Center is an agency that we've worked with. I think since they started doing the coordinated entry, we have received almost all, if not all, of our referrals from them. So we have a lot of experience collaborating with not only HSC, but other agencies around the community. So working with them so they know what our referral criteria is and making sure that we're getting the most appropriate participants for our program. Exactly.
There are some different nuances, and I guess I probably let Monk speak to Community Services Northwest and Diane to share. I guess usually Community Services Northwest have more of a clinical link in their services that they're providing. So the clients that they would have referred to them from the Housing Solutions Center would have some form of mental health, behavioral health, needs that clients that would be referred to share will not necessarily have. And Salvation Army is, I'll let them talk to you through the nuance, but you know, generally they've been more focused on prevention as opposed to homeless and chronic homeless. So it'd be a lighter, you know, a lighter touch. But I'm not sure what to expect in terms of their presentation. So there are some nuances, but that's absolutely, you know, legitimate question to ask whenever we have the presentations for TBRA and case management. And after all the presentations are done, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about things to look for when you're evaluating projects about TBRA, rapid rehousing, case management, things to look for and aid you in your grading of that.
Thank you. No, very well put. So community services, like Michael said, we address more of the mental health and behavioral health issues or problems that arise. So with our agency having multiple different services available, we can provide much more stronger wraparound services. So the case manager can work with individual's mental health clinician or their chemical dependency counselor. And then, of course, we also connect with other services through Columbia River Mental Health, like with their supportive employment program, so we can make sure everybody's on the same page and everything's working together for the individual. Oh. And before I leave you guys,
tenant-based rental assistance. So that's it's really rental, rapid rehousing, rental assistance, but home, the housing urban development, home investment partnership program. They call it tenant-based rental assistance.
Send one up to the gauntlet or what?
Hi, my name is Megan Connolly. I'm a housing case manager this year's Fire Program. The goal of our program is to ensure that each of our participants are stably housed, as well as to ensure that they achieve self-sufficiency at the end of our program. We do hold our participants accountable to achieve this goal. And the funding that we're asking for is going to be used mostly for but it will be used towards intensive case management for our clients. And the clients will be receiving the home funding subsidies. And case management is an integral part of what we do at Inspire. And the case managers will assess, plan, implement, coordinate, monitor, and evaluate the options and the services required to meet the resources and health needs of our clients. We also focus on housing stability and placement, with an emphasis on the arrangement, the coordination, monitoring, and delivery of services related to the housing needs. And we also work on improving housing stability through case management with our participants. The case manager will have a caseload of about 30 to 35 participants, and we do work with a strength-based model. And the case managers will meet with their clients a minimum of one time a month. Depending on the client's needs, we may meet with them more often. Some situations we may meet once a week or even three times a week if needed. And the case manager will assess with the client both their short and long-term needs. And they'll be setting individualized goals for the clients, identifying the strengths and the skills of the clients to best meet the needs and goals of the clients. And the client and the case manager together will formulate a goal and a plan to obtain these goals and action. The case manager does create and maintain a healthy relationship with the client, as well as the client beginning to trust the case manager. The case manager acts as a support, a mediator, and a trustworthy interpreter on behalf of the clients receiving outside resources. And they also provide positive accountability and encouragement. And oftentimes, the case managers will also transport the clients to housing searches to help them find apartments or homes and also to meet with their landlords. We also provide home quality inspections for the clients for potential housing to make sure that the house that they or the home they move into is going to be safe and suitable for the clients. And the case manager also acts as a liaison between the clients and any services that they may need. And they also advocate for the households with the landlords. Our tenants will pay no more, or our participants will pay no more than 30% of their income towards their rent. And as their income does increase, their subsidy for their part will also increase. And as mentioned, the clients do meet Aspire does work with more than 100 landlords. These are both apartment complexes and private landlords. We do like to work with the private landlords, but they tend to be a little more forgiving. Their screening process is a little less strict and cumbersome. And then we also have the Cromhold Center. If you've been, we do have classrooms in the back that we do offer for our clients. We do have a six-week program for tenant-based rental assistance. And with those classes, it's that they learn how to be a good tenant and how to follow the rules and laws, and that class is known as rent roll. We also offer financial assistance and education classes, and we have also partnered with WorkSource to provide employment opportunities and assistance for them. One of our clients that has been through the home funding program, she was a single mother of three children who were the ages of 15, 7, and 3, and they were fleeing a domestic violence situation, and the children were completely traumatized from this situation. This was her first time ever experiencing homelessness, and she had been married for several years. She was a homeowner, and she also was a successful realtor in the community. The domestic violence had become so severe for her that she had to flee her home, and she did get an apartment for her and her children. So she did not obtain a restraining order. She thought she was doing what was right for the kids, and she didn't want to cause more hardship on them. So her husband did find her in the apartment complex, and he would terrorize her, and the abuse got even worse while she was in her apartment. It got so bad that she had to leave her own apartment, and she went and moved in with her sister. So while living with her sister, her husband did find her, and he would terrorize her at her sister's home, and it got so bad that she could no longer live with her sister or family. And so then she started couch surfing and going from home to home, trying to have somewhere to live. Oftentimes, her and her children would have to be separated because her friends would not have enough space for everybody. The abuser would then come to her job, and he would terrorize her, and her job caused issues, and eventually she had lost her job, which resulted in her becoming homeless. So she could no longer pay for the places that she was staying at for her and her children, and her friends no longer wanted to put up with her abusive husband. And she had thought about trying to collect child support to help with some of the financial aspects, but her husband would constantly flee the country, making it hard to get child support. But he would often come back and terrorize her, and it even got to the point where he would threaten to kill her in front of her children. With nowhere to go, she was reluctant about obtaining services, and eventually she decided to take the advice of a friend and apply for housing through the Housing Solutions Center. And with that, she got on the home program, and during her 2 years in the program, she was able to address her domestic violence issues, get a restraining order, she obtained a divorce, she filed bankruptcy, she accessed legal services, and she was also able to access mental health services for both her and her children. She successfully obtained employment again as a realtor and was able to get back into the community. She successfully graduated off of the program, feeling confident, safe, and stably housed. And she says that her success is totally due to the program and the caring support and guidance that she received from her case manager during her case management meetings. She stated that if it had not been for the funding and the Aspire program, she would probably be dead, and she probably would have gone back to living with her homeless or living with her abuser who's not having anywhere to go. Aspire is a program, not a project. We are asking for $250,000 in home transitional funding and $50,000 for the CDBG for case management.
Any questions?
Will you go on with the partial? If you ask for $300,000, right?
Uh-huh.
So you get $100,000.
It would be very difficult to continue to house these participants because the majority of the funding does go to the rental subsidies.
And all of us, of course, are in Vancouver. So how much of your client list is outside of Vancouver?
It's all Clark County, and we have participants housed in Battleground, Washougal, Kansas, and Richfield.
So one thing that the Housing Solutions Center would speak to a little bit more, but it's actually a lot easier right now to find housing to put people, to rehouse people in outside of the city of Vancouver. So generally speaking, when rental assistance is being provided, odds are it's outside of city limits just because of housing availability and cost. Just FYI.
just out of curiosity, the training that you say that is set up, is that required? Or if it isn't required, what kind of attendance do you have?
The training for the clients?
Learning.
Like the problem center, like different sessions that you do.
Those are from certified individuals. As far as Rentwell, they have gone through a Rentwell training class. And then WorkSource is at their own company that they bring in. And then for financial, I believe we bring people in. So pretty much the classes are brought in from other outside agencies to help our clients.
But what kind of attendance do you have of those in need? Those are the ones that you're helping. That's who it's for.
Mm-hmm. As far as requirements,
it's encouraging.
It's encouraging. So it's all awesome, I'm guessing. So
it is. The case manager highly encourages and motivates the client to attend this class.
I guess the question I'm hearing, though, is what's the rate of attendance? Like, you know, it's voluntary, but do you have a percentage or kind of an idea of how much are people going to the class?
For our
student
education class.
Well, I know you have several different classes.
Yeah, you're asking what our outcomes are, how many people actually attend percentage-wise.
Yeah.
I would say we have about an 80%
attendance.
80%?
About an 80% attendance.
And then the success rate on 80% is?
Probably about 50%. Because it's not mandatory, because we use a housing first kind of model, and so because it's not mandatory, a lot of our participants will come the first time or the second time, and they have to get a model, but we invite them to come the first time.
What's the average length of time you're providing rental assistance before they become self-sustaining? And that's one question. Then second question is how many cases will the request fund?
The maximum amount we would offer is 24 months. We try to get them self-sustained as quickly as possible. It varies from case to case, depending on what their barriers are and what they come from. And then the second question?
The average.
How many, the 250,000 asked for rental assistance, how many people will that serve?
It serves about 35. Yeah, we serve an average 35 per year.
So our mission and vision with the Salvation Army we exist to provide humanitarian care for those in need, ministering to body, mind, and spirit. Our vision in Clark County, we envision a county where basic human needs are met. Our values and priorities can be summed up in the following. We value all people without discrimination, demonstrating a warmth and personal interest in each person, listening without judgment. We value the respect and dignity of all individuals, recognizing the worth and dignity of each, and affirming the right of each one to make his or her own decisions. We value programs as an avenue for meeting those human needs. And our priority is to increase community visibility as a way to reach out to those in most need. One way we do that is we want to expand programs to meet the community's ever-growing need. We want to recognize our limitations to assist those who are in need. And we
we want to collaborate and network with other agencies as necessary for the assistance of those clients in need. Our priority is to be a welcoming place for all, where staff begin with the need expressed by the client and work with the clients to build that rapport and trust. And how do we fulfill this? One way is through this program, Guiding Light. The Salvation Army meets people at the point of their need, whether that be physical, emotional, or spiritual. We offer a personal and individual response. We model understanding and compassion, and we recognize that each person is unique and valuable. As a partner agency, we come together for the common good of those we are all called to serve. We realize that no one agency has all the resources, but everyone has something to contribute. So we like to network with a lot of different agencies, as Cher has mentioned, the Housing Solutions Center, PIC, Partners in Careers, WorkSource. We all network together. We also know that finding a common purpose is best for all of us. Working together strengthens the community, and a stronger community produces lasting results. Guiding Light is a comprehensive program designed to educate, to guide, and to motivate participants to succeed in achieving their goals. We work with individuals along with other providers to move people forward to self-sufficiency by providing housing assistance. Through this program, we are reaching out to those with housing instability by offering housing assistance, one-on-one coaching, and budgeting. We resolve housing instability by helping people stay in their homes or find the right place. We work extensively with landlords and tenants to reach a mutually satisfying agreement. We follow up as needed, either weekly, biweekly, or monthly, depending on what the need is for that client, depending on what their barriers are, it could be more. We will identify those barriers and assist each family or household to move towards self-sufficiency with the development of a housing stability plan. And within that plan, we will address full-time employment, reducing personal debt and increasing their savings, establishing good rental history and becoming a good tenant, time management and accountability, safe and reliable child care, and maintaining personal health. Here's one of our success stories. Haley is a 31-year-old woman with two children fleeing domestic violence who has resorted to sleeping in her car. Through a referral from the Housing Solutions Center, the Salvation Army is able to make that connection. Haley wrestled with the knowledge that they were without income, job skills, or shelter. Her only concern was finding a safe place to live for her 16-year-old and 14-month-old sons. Haley was able to find a part-time minimum wage job. She was grateful for that job, but permanent housing remained her number one priority. Through phone calls and meetings, she shared her frustration with the rental application process. We learned some of her barriers, which included lack of work history, poor credit, and property debts. After months of looking, Haley was able to find a place, and with the help from the Salvation Army T-Bro Rental Subsidy Program, she was approved to move in. Haley has since been promoted to a full-time management position. So our housing assistance breakdown for 2016 was 61 unduplicated families were served with housing assistance from this program. And you can see where some of our monies come from. CDBG has the biggest portion, and we have United Way dollars, our TSA dollars, and we have a DFS program as well.
TSA is what?
Salvation Army, sorry.
Oh,
the
Salvation
Army.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay. I get it.
I should have wrote that out, thank you. The Salvation Army has been in Clark County for 125 plus years. We have stability and longevity. Help us help others. And your support is greatly appreciated.
So are you guys firefighters as well? By if
putting out fires,
if there's a problem,
crisis,
you stand between
yes.
the tenant and the
absolutely.
Network?
We are a big liaison between them, and we work directly with the landlord to say, we know this client is a risk to you, but we want to help lower that risk because we're going to work with them for so many months. And if you will just give them that chance, you can see that they're going to work on this, this, and this. So Yeah, it's basically, please give this person a chance. They've done this, they've gone to classes, they can go to Brentwell, they're working on employment, and kind of lowering that risk for the landlord, kind of putting them at ease.
And what's your success rate? Of the 61 there,
I'm a new case manager. My name is Diane Harmon. I just came on board in July, relieving Carol Mavala, who went to WorkSource. So some of those folks are coming to us through other options. Housing Solutions Center does a really great job of actually screening folks, so we sort of know what those risks are ahead of time. But the program initially was like 3 months. Let's see what they can do in 3 months. How can we help them? We're finding that there's a lot more barriers. So I said, we've got to go longer. We've got to go longer than 90 days. Most of us building relationships, if you only visit with somebody once a month, how much information are you going to share? So we've extended it 6 months, and a lot of the clients that I get to work with are now 9 months. So we're reducing more of those barriers and seeing them fulfill full term of a 12-month lease. And that alone, doing that, enables them to build that credit again. And so they're overcoming those barriers, but success, I only have about 6 months information for me. Beth has a longer term amount of information, but finding out and building those trusts with folks and finding out if they'll be honest and tell us what the barriers are is the biggest hurdle, honestly. And even knowing that your landlord is sort of the eyes on the scene. If they see something's happening that's causing them to be at risk in their environment, they will share that too, and then we can address it during case management. So success for me, Haley was one of those that came to WorkSource, and you know, actually getting to see her and talk to her on the phone, even it's a success when she shares that with me. It's not necessarily comes down in numbers, it's how sometimes people feel, how they're getting along, how they're dealing with their employers, their coworkers, their families. So money-wise, I think we have thrown about an average of about $5,000 per family, which doesn't seem like a lot over a period of time of 3 months. Even in a year, when you say $5,000 investment, did they find all the resources that they needed to make a success long term? So that's what we're seeing is they continue to get that strength and confidence, and to us, that is a success for them. Yeah.
So it sounds like there's two. So you have the potentially long-term counseling, and then there's a separate thing, the question of the financial piece. So you've got, you know, you maybe the rental assistance goes for some period of time, but you maintain that counseling relationship.
Longer.
So,
yeah, they can definitely come back, and we can track them to see where they're at after they finish financially with us. We have a lot of clients that will just come back to trace with us, let us know how they're doing, but they'll update us on their job, their employment. So it can definitely, that case management piece can definitely yield longer versus the financial.
Yeah. So, and this is not directed at you, it's actually not directed at any specific organization, it's more for everyone's information. So we are tracking right now, and we're getting the data for rates of successful exit to permanent housing from every program, and we are tracking the cost per successful exit for each program. So I think that's really, really important for all the service providers to know. Because the question that I'm hearing asked, that I'm not really hearing answered, and I think should be prepared for in these presentations is, our exit rate is 60% of referrals, and out of those 60%, 12 months from now, 100% or 80% or 70% are still stably housed. So that's the answer that I think I'm hearing being asked for. And everyone needs to be ready to provide, and just be aware, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years from now, moving forward, in the COC steering committee and in forums, we're we're going to be talking about the different types of intervention. You know, this program has a cost per successful exit of X amount of dollars, you know, and we'll be able to do some comparisons like that through HMIS. So that's not directed at you or anyone, it's more for everyone's information. My desire is in future, I don't know if we're going to have it ready for next year, but in future presentations at the UCPB, when programs are presenting requesting funds, having that information provided, if there is prior experience.
I mean, to that point, I mean, I literally have a note here, so what's success rate, and then which programs deliver best long-term results, and we're looking at, right here this morning, three programs that do similar things, and the funds are limited, so, and not that you want to compete with each other necessarily, and nor do we want pressure for, you know, forced data, but where do we take limited resources and provide them in the place where they make it the most benefit to those in the future?
And I do have a question actually for you. So I saw an application, and I've seen this presentation again, speaking of providing the funds to help people stay in their home. And the RFA and what we're requiring is these dollars are for people who are homeless. It's not prevention dollars, is rehousing dollars. So you aren't keeping people in their current homes, correct? Okay, thank you.
It's kind of a two-fold model where it can be used. This model can be used for prevention as well as rather rehousing. But for the CDBG home, it is for homeless prevention, getting people out of shelters into permanent housing.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I had a quick question too. So in your success story, you said she was looking around for housing for months, but I was wondering what your agency is doing to help people find housing.
We are working with the clients, working with the landlords, trying to reduce the barriers. Some of our families come with huge property debts. Some come with mental health issues, and so the landlords have such high risk. They're not willing to rent to them, or they don't have the income debt ratio that they're looking for. And so we're working one-on-one with them and the landlords to say, we know this person is a high risk to you, but this is the contract with us. This is what we're willing to do. You can see that we're going to pay part of their rent. They're going to pay 30%. And like Cher explained, our programs are very similar, is that if they get increased income, their amount goes up, our amount decreases. And so we're working with those clients to say, which apartment can you, as we're looking for apartments, which can you really afford? Which long-term, when you're off this program, to be self-sufficient, do you feel that you can be self-stabilized in? So sometimes it does take a long time. We have a low vacancy rate. We have families that have 6-plus kids and trying to find apartments big enough. There's just not places to put them all. And so that's another reason that could take a while.
More questions?
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
Two things. One is some of those specific questions are probably better answered by Andy Silver from the Council for the Homeless. And I'd be very happy to bring him in for a future presentation to just give you an overview of the stats for Clark County when it comes to rates of homelessness, rates of place, you know, like rates of entry into the homeless system through the Housing Solutions Center. And the rates of placement. So we do not know get what the 2017 point in time count final numbers are, because that just took place January 26th. The 2016, I believe it was 888 for the point in time count. Generally, and that's just a snapshot. That's not a census. And the point of the purpose behind the point in time count is just to figure out trends. Let's use the tool for what it's at. Generally speaking, the homeless population in the community is at least three times higher than the point in time count. You know, so we're looking at, in Clark County, a homeless population of over 2,000. That relates to what the Housing Solutions Center has been seeing. About 82% of people coming to the Housing Solutions Center are unsheltered. You know, so they're not couch surfing, they're not leaving a home, they're literally, you know, on the street. Their placement, my understanding, and you know, since I wasn't anticipating this question, you know, per se, the placement rate over a period of months is about 60%. For the people seeking assistance, like in terms of eventually getting into a home, if they have a rent lease, they're getting some kind of rental assistance. And the amount of time people are getting assistance is between 9 and 12 months on average. And the cost for successful exit from rapid rehousing in Clark County is about $7,900. Right now, so that's, you know, that's kind of like run down.
I don't understand that. What does that mean?
That means that when someone no longer from the moment someone goes into the system, like, you know, I'm homeless, I go to Housing Solutions Center, I get assessed, eventually I get into housing, I receive some case management, I receive some rental assistance, I may receive some other services. The total cost, case management, rental assistance, everything, you know, like what it costs to get the person assessed, that's your cost per successful exit for when all that assistance stops. Like I can manage on my own.
Fly little bird, fly.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what I mean, or what is meant by cost per success, total cost per successful exit. So, you know, that's what it is in Clark County. You
does,
know,
that,
what it's worth.
Does that include those who don't want assistance but
no, that
want
includes,
to get off the streets
that,
because
that
it's so dang cold?
That is cost per successful exit. That is person who has been served. Okay, you know, in a rapid rehousing program. You know, the total cost. It's not total system cost.
Right.
You know, averaged out to successful exit, you know, which is what you're asking for. And I think we could probably come up with that as well.
Well, if I could, so I sit on the Council for the Homeless Board as well, and last week Andy just did sort of recap on some of the stuff,
yeah.
So I think we could probably get that presentation,
yeah.
Get it out to everyone. There's some data there. But the one thing that sticks in my head is that only a small percentage of those who come in and ask for assistance actually get any.
Correct.
There's just
and certainly get assistance immediately is a tiny portion, you know, and if you
right,
spread it out
months before.
Yeah, if you spread it out over a course of a 12-month period, eventually most people are getting assistance, but it's eventually, you know,
right.
it's over, you know.
So I'll see if I can't get that, if you guys are interested in it, I'll
yeah.
Answer
that. Yeah. Yeah. I was, you know, when you're waiting factors, you're going to help somebody buy a home, you're going to get somebody off the street.
Yeah, well, and I would just, you know, homeless crisis response system is a different animal than affordable housing. There's definitely a linkage, you know, there's a relationship there, but they're two completely different things. So what I would encourage you to do when you look at proposals for affordable housing, you know, I'd really be looking at more like cost per door, you know, longevity of what that investment will be in the community. You know, and there are all kinds of factors to consider. I mean, like, you know, even in affordable housing, I mean, you have apples and oranges and mangoes and stuff like that, you know, so you're not going to get like a one-to-one, but, you know, but that, those are, that's the kind of stuff that I would look at.
Yeah, it's like, I think Ron was saying that, kind of alluding to, you know, when he was talking about, is it voluntary, is it mandatory, some of these programs, you know, it's, you know, does that make a difference in the success rate when you make people have to be invested in going to these classes or not going to these classes?
So we have some of that data, and just so you know, and I'll actually, this is probably a good segue to the next part of our meeting, and this will be fast, but you know what I'm going to discuss too is what do we mean by rapid rehousing? You know, so when you see in the RFA, the request for application, that hey, Clark County is requiring these service providers to do a housing first rapid rehousing program that goes through a housing solution center. What does that really mean? You know, so that you have some idea of things to look for. One of the components of rapid rehousing is that volunteer piece. And the reason why that is a component in rapid rehousing is because the success rates of programs that use a volunteer model is actually higher than programs that have done this is data that's been compiled like since the 80s. You know, so there's a lot of information out there. You know, it's not just a guess piece. But the odds of someone completing a program, failing out of it, or becoming ineligible, getting disqualified, and having to reenter it with a penalty and stuff like that, is actually, you know, much lower success rates, which translates to a higher cost for the program type than programs that have actually followed a voluntary service model. So when a program says it's not a requirement, and you know, even when I hear a case manager say, well, you know, this is the rate, but it's not but it's because it's not mandatory, you know, for some of us that have been doing this, you know, for the past, you know, 10, 15 years or whatever, and have have looked a lot at the statistics and stuff, I'd be like, well, your completion rate for that class might be higher if you had a mandatory piece, but your success rate in completing an entire program and your success rate in achieving permanent housing might be much lower, which translates to a higher total program cost. You know, so but let me get in. I mean, we could go. Go ahead.
Do these folks know that we don't have a master's in social work? That we, I can't speak for Wade, but let me just say for me, when I spend other people's money, I want to know if, for instance, the Salvation Army is better at it than SHARE.
Yeah.
And are they told, you know, this really, to me, and I, maybe Jeff and Ron or whomever else, boils down to if you're not performing, then maybe it's time that you move out and we find a performer. Because I appreciate stories, but I appreciate more that when I take someone else's tax dollar and give it to someone, that they get 11 cents out of that dime. I don't, the story's fine, but 11 cents out of the dime is more important to me.
So I think in theory they know. You know, I think that it's very irregular in the community in terms of you know, there are differences between the service providers and really understanding that, and even within that, who is being sent to present, you know, there are some differences in that as well. So, you know, but what I can say is we, meaning the county staff, and honestly, with also, I think some leadership among service providers and things like the coalition, the Continuum of Care Steering Committee, which is a planning group around the homeless crisis response system, around the Council for the Homeless, are definitely messaging that to all the service providers. And honestly, the game is changing. in terms of what is being asked for in terms of information and performance benchmarks from the service providers and outputs and outcomes. You know, so things that are very, very critical to us being able to do this is all service providers are using a common information database so that we know points of entry, services provided, costs for different services, duration of time the service was provided, time of exit. By that I mean that they stopped using the program, they stopped receiving any kind of assistance, and if that same individual and household ever comes back into the system at any point, and when I'm saying system, I mean whether it's Housing Solutions Center or SHARE or Salvation Army, you know, stuff like that, you know, so that we know, oh, we've seen this person again, you know, and it was only 6 months ago, or it's been 3 years, you know, and these were the issues, the barriers that were addressed last time at you know, that cost. So this community is definitely getting there, and there's definitely a lot of room for growth in that. But the benchmarks we're looking at are going to be amount of time spent homeless, amount of time in the system, expenses in the system, what they exited to. Did they just fall out of whatever program they were in and disappear? Did they exit to permanent housing? What's the total cost for successful exit? And then if they ever come back in to the system, what, you know, recidivism rate, you know, total system recidivism rate, you know, meaning what percentage of people are coming back and after what amount of time. So those are things we're tracking.
And I think we'll have to be careful long-term not to have, because we all, I think, are on the same page with this, but not to have so the forced pressure into creating data that allows them to be higher on the list. So
yes.
We make sure we track the actual, we're not pressured into, like, okay, well, he's out, but we'll put him in permanent housing so that it looks better. You know,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I think we have to be careful of that, too, as we go along and manage through this data piece. And also to your point, over the last year, kind of getting into this homelessness and housing, I think this housing first model has the most. I mean, it's hard to ask somebody to get their act together when they don't have a place to live. So doing that first shows over time that there's a higher success rate long term for those once they have a place to live. So.
And at lower cost.
Yes.
And there's two things that hit me in the face. I don't mean to belabor any points, but I would almost rather have, but how do you, where do you make the cut? But I would rather have a smaller program with a higher success rate so that we don't, and I'm wondering what the repeat, what the cycle is in repeating, but if we can get out of that repeating cycle, that a smaller program that has a high success rate is much more desirable to me. And at the same time, I'm looking at the presenters, and God knows, I mean, we're sitting around here. We're not all as old as I am, I know, but we're all older generation, and there's so many young people. They gotta be just stunned with what they're faced with. And, you know, how do you... I feel sorry for some of them. I mean, my goodness, what are they? Do they go to work and think, "Oh my God, I'm already defeated"? You know, I just, and some of the rest of us, you know, as we get older, I don't know what it is, but you know, we accept more defeatism or whatever you want to call it.
Well, so, and I think this is all part of the discussion of things to know when scoring. But you know, we're going to have future application processes with HOME and CDBG, where one way or another, we're being asked to fund the homeless crisis response system. You know, and the community is going to be, you know, at different levels of need. You know. know, right now there's a pretty high need and demand in Clark County for homeless services. You know, maybe 3 or 4 years from now there'll be less, but there'll always be some level of need to assess. You know, I guess I would message there are communities in this country with the resources that they have and that have achieved what is called functional zero in terms of homelessness for different different demographics. So you might have like families with children, you might have veterans, you might have people who are experiencing chronic homelessness, you know, which means, you know, a certain thing. So they might reach functional zero, meaning there might still be someone in the street, but the capacity in the community is such that when someone becomes homeless, there's the ability to identify them and rapidly rehouse them. You know, so they stay housed. Roughly speaking, that's kind of what functional zero means. So you don't have this demand far exceeding the capacity. So
that's in communities that have no growth. So
well, not necessarily. Park. You know, I mean, so Portland has achieved it with veterans. You know, so you know that's nearby. New York City, believe it or not, last year and a half ago achieved the chronic homeless individuals. You know, so. You know, so to an extent, the system can get there, and part of our job is to help the system get there, help the community, help the service providers develop the ability to do those things. So, you know, the way you do it is by making sure that it is a systemic approach, that they are tracking their, you know, collecting the data, measuring the things, checking the cost per exit, going with fidelity to a model like Housing First and stuff like that, and that you're being held accountable to do it.
Yes, we're not enabling, we're actually making them do their job instead of just giving these funds out there, throwing at problems and not finding solutions.
But the reality is also, and I really believe this, is, you know, these are good organizations, they're mission-centric. Mm-hmm. Once they get it, once they understand that by doing a system approach, it helps them fulfill their mission, they're willing participants once they get it. You know, and we're still a lot like in the growth curve. But that's the kind of things that you're going to be seeing you know, as we move forward. But I'd like to start with doing a quick board proponents of rapid rehousing, or do you want to do those
programs
first?
I was going to ask the board if they wanted to have Andy Silver do a little brief informational meeting on the homelessness and homeless system before we support the 2017 applications, or do you want to just get that information later in the year?
Does he do it by zip code?
He has it.
Yes.
By zip code.
I mean, I'd like to hear from him because, you know, I know quite a bit about Battleground. I know more about Richfield because Ron bores me with all that. But I would like to hear.
Before the March 6th scoring meeting? Or just later in the year as a regular monthly.
Can he send a presentation by zip code to my email so that I can read it at home?
I can ask him.
I'm not a,
if
you
can't, like, well, you'll have an opportunity to say no.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to hear that, if it's possible, one way or the other.
You want to go to Zoom grants first or after
you
have?
Oh, sure. You want me to start with Zoom grants? That's simple. And we just made a one-page handout, which the text is totally unreadable. We know that. But the important part is the arrows that kind of point you where you go on each screen, and you've had the full training before. So this is just a little cheat sheet, I guess you'd call it, to walk you through each of the steps from logging in, reading the applications, and then entering the scores. So Rebecca and I are both, and Michael will be available at any time for any technical assistance as you get into this, but nothing has changed from year to year. So just a quick snapshot to refer to if you need to.
And also reflected in the Zoom grant comments, and as you're scoring, you know, we ask you to just briefly look at this. This is a short, very, very short, not subjective. We've really taken a lot of pains to try to not be subjective and tell you what you should score or who you should favor, you know, vote your conscience, grade your conscience, but this gives you some history on the different proposals and the history of the different service providers with these sources of funds. So, you know, just to inform you as you're scoring. And I'll, if you're ready, I'll start with just a quick primer on rent-free housing, which is as simple as I can make it. Okay, so, you know, so as already mentioned, we have required anyone that's requesting home, PBRA, and CDBG case management funds to use a rapid rehousing model and receive all referrals for housing through the Housing Solutions Center. And what that means in terms of receiving referrals from the Housing Solutions Center is that people who are experiencing homelessness, if they call 211, if they call the Council for the Homeless, if they walk into any of our any service provider in this community and they need rehousing, they need, you know, I'm homeless, I need to get in a house, I need rental assistance, I need whatever, they're going to be sent to the Housing Solutions Center. That is a single point of entry for county-funded rental assistance, case management, homeless services in Clark County.
What are the numbers in that?
Say again?
What are the numbers in that? I mean, is it, it does the phone ring off the hook?
So you can do a walk-in and you can access them via phone, and they also do outreach. The phone is available 46 hours a week, and it is pretty, it fluctuates, but it is pretty constant ringing. I'll get you the numbers in terms of phone calls and walk-ins per month. But I think, if I remember Andy Silver talking, they're getting about 2,000 people a year, you know, that are needing services, you know, and each of those individuals are probably calling and walking in multiple times. So it's pretty busy. And when I say, you know, so you can walk in, you can call in, and when I set out, they have some people that will, you know, they'll go out to locations where they know there are people who are experiencing homelessness, and they'll do an assessment. So these are things that happen, and this is why we require going through Housing Solutions Center. What takes place there is they get an assessment to identify what their level of need is, because we don't have resources to rehouse and help everyone immediately. So the ones that get assistance now or sooner are the ones that are most vulnerable, the ones that are physically most likely, to oversimplify it, most likely to die sooner if they're not helped. That's who gets helped first. And that may include people escaping domestic violence, people with small children, people with, you know, some higher levels of health needs. And it's a standardized assessment called VI-SPDAT, which is a vulnerability index that is done, and it's been studied and developed nationwide. Once they have that assessment and they identify, what they do is, by identifying those barriers, is they'll look at the different service providers and what their capacities are and be like, based on this person's need and the availability for that service out there, they need to go to this program. So they'll make a referral. And so I'm homeless, I go to Housing Solutions Center, they assess me, I have a specific need, and let's say the Community Services Northwest is what, you know, it's really the service that is most appropriate for me, they have an opening, I will be referred to Community Services Northwest. They have to accept me. They do not have a choice. Okay, so it's really a hard referral, you know? And that's why you had that presenter that was talking about, well, we don't really deal with the wait list. That's what the Housing Solutions Center does. If they have an opening, the Housing Solutions Center is aware that they have an opening, that's when they make that referral. That organization is required to accept them. They cannot turn them away. So that's what we mean by the county in terms of, you're required to take referrals from the Housing Solutions Center. That means the Housing Solutions Center is the point of entry for your program.
They've already done the work.
Yes.
They've already done
they've already done that assessment. They're sending people that they know are eligible and meet the requirements for entry to that program.
Well, that eliminates those individual other folks having to do that themselves. They don't have to do that.
Absolutely. Well, what it does, and the reason, and that's a nationally accepted best practice. That is what Housing and Urban Development, Department of Housing and Urban Development, has been moving all communities to go towards. That's what the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness recommends. That's what the National Alliance on Homelessness recommends. It's really a way to go. And the benefits of that is, number one, if you are someone in need, you don't have to go knocking on 12 different doors to hopefully get some assistance. You know, it also means that if you are a community with different service providers, as soon as there's an opening, that opening is going to get used by someone who is appropriate for that service based on a vulnerability. Like it's a community level triage and effective utilization of resources, and it prevents duplication of services, duplication of funding, duplication of efforts. You know, and it requires coordination between the service providers and providing services and case management. And you know, the other benefit is it lets us identify and measure, you know, who's coming into the system, what they're receiving, what was assessed, you know, come up with those strengths. So that's the coordination piece. But you know, that we require. But we also require housing. So what is that? So that's an intervention that is basically helps people quickly exit homelessness and return to permanent housing. It is assistance that is offered without preconditions. And what that means is not you have eligibility criteria, but that eligibility criteria is based on vulnerability and need. It's based on your housing status. It's not based on, am I enrolled in X program? Am I sober? The essence of housing first is first you house them and you provide the support services they need to address the barriers that they have, as opposed to requiring them to get rid of the barriers before you house them. And the reason for that is because the success rates are much, much higher. There are three components to rapid rehousing. The first component is, you know, so every program that says we do rapid rehousing must do these things, okay, to be accurate when they say rapid rehousing. One is housing identification. They work with landlords, they recruit landlords to provide housing opportunities for the population they're serving. They address, you know, they prepare landlords to the barriers that the households are receiving, you know, that they have, so that it's not a surprise to the landlords. And they assist the households that they're serving find the appropriate housing that they need, okay? Another component of voluntary service, by the way, is if I'm the person being rehoused, I am the final say on the housing that I get. Doesn't mean that I can choose a McMansion or multiplex or anything like that, but it does mean that, let's say I'm going to Community Services Northwest, they cannot say, hey, we have an opening in this house, take it or leave it, okay? Ultimately, the one that decides, hey, I have a kid, I have a wife, I have, there are three people in my household, that house will meet my needs. No, it won't, you know? So ultimately, that's what we mean by that. So they assist households find the appropriate housing for them, but they're the ones that make that final choice. So one component is that housing identification. The second component is rent and move-in assistance. And that's what we talk about with the tenant-based rental assistance, those home dollars to pay for rental assistance. That's the component we're talking about. So that's the dollars to pay for the rent every month or whatever proportion of the rent that they're funding. And often, you know, we can't always do this with PBRA, but the program might be assisting with move-in costs, you know, some expenses, whether it be a cleaning deposit, whether it be, you know, something like that. So that's that second component. And the third component is case management and services. So all three things that housing identification assistance, that rental assistance piece, and that case management piece all need to exist in a program to be considered rapid rehousing. And, you know, we often ask, well, what are we talking about when we mean case management? That is assistance helping those households identify and select the among the different housing options, what would be best for them based on their unique needs. Assistance identifying and addressing their issues, their barriers to housing stability, whether it be credit history, arrears, pending legal issues, addictions, you know, things like that. Assistance negotiating with the landlords and signing a fair lease, you know, a standard legal lease. Making appropriate referrals and connections to time-limited services that they may need to help them achieve that stability and address those barriers. Monitoring the progress that they're making based on whatever plans have been created, following through with their services, you know, and you know, that. Helping them make the referrals and connections that are appropriate. So let's say that I have issues with credit or money management. Helping me make that referral to that program that would help me address those specific barriers that I have and monitoring and assisting with the follow-through. And, you know, making sure that the services that are being provided are appropriate for my specific situation. So what we also do not want and would not be efficient in our services is, let's say that, okay, I'm homeless, I go to Housing Solutions Center, they send me to Community Services Northwest, and they go, okay, you know, you have, this is the program we provide, A, B, C, D, E, and F, you know, and Sam gets the same exact program she, you know, because that's what we provide, that's our formula. And it has nothing to do with the differences between Sam and I and what we may be experiencing and what our different needs are. So part of that client-centered case management is making sure that the services we are providing are the services that we need and only the services that we need, and that we're receiving them for the minimum time necessary, which means being different people with different needs, it's going to be a different service plan. You know, that we're getting. So that's what we mean by case management. You know, so when we're asking, and that's what that those CDBG dollars are supposed to be funding in terms of case management. So that's rapid rehousing in a nutshell. Any questions?
So, One point quickly. As I ask everyone, if they only get half, and I can't remember how the system works, will it allow me to save 25 grand to Columbia River Mental Health on the thing, or is it just, I just roll them out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and however they fall, they fall?
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
You don't get the budget yourself.
No. Budget is about.
Well, so the only other thing, you know, on the agenda is just a reminder, the bus tour is on February 27th, and please score your applications by Monday, March 6th.
We're at 8:30?
The bus tour starts at 8.
At 8.
At the health department.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Health service. Okay. Correct.
Yes.
Oh,
man.
Missed the cruise.
You missed me on that bus tour.
Yeah, last year was raining.
Anything else?
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
But the people are
paper.
Yeah, however, please take the fire
and file all these.
Go to the line before
I'm going to
go to the
house. See
you
later.
I'll
look at your
you
might, yeah. So let's begin.
Right.
excited.